From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Current Affairs producer Iakovos Balassi. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Michael Weiss, co-author of a recently published book, ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror. Michael is also a senior editor at the Daily Beast, a columnist for foreign policy, and contributor to CNN. Michael Weiss has covered the Syrian conflict since the beginning of the peaceful uprising against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in 2011. The book ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror, which is on the New York Times bestseller list, gives an in-depth profile of the terror group that is known as ISIS or ISIL, also Daesh. It covers in great detail the origins and evolution of the group, thoroughly discussing its origins in Iraq, its split with al-Qaeda, and its advance in Syria. It discusses the group's primary players and the impact they've had in creating a terrorist organization that now controls a large swath of land in eastern Syria and western Iraq. The book explores the ways in which the group interacts with the people it rules and how it is able to run a functioning society. Not only does the group operate in Iraq and Syria, but it has also gained numerous affiliates around the world, most notably Boko Haram in Nigeria. ISIS proclaimed itself a so-called caliphate in June of 2014, pretentiously claiming authority over the world's Muslims. Its ability to recruit foreign fighters has gone unmatched and has added yet another layer to the difficulty of managing the group's growth and success. And Michael Weiss joins us from a studio in New York City. Michael Weiss, congratulations again on your book. It's a New York Times bestseller. But let me put this central question to you, which you sought to address in the book, which is, where did ISIS come from and how did it manage to do so much damage in such a short period of time?
ISIS used to be known as al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is an organization founded in 2004 by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who prior to that had not been a member of al-Qaeda, but in 2004, after having conducted a series of spectacular terror attacks in occupied Iraq, essentially pledged allegiance to al-Qaeda in exchange for which he got all of the financial revenue from their international syndicate. It really didn't start out as the main threat in Iraq, even though the Bush administration at the time had said that that was basically the only insurgency that the U.S. military was fighting. It was the tip of the spear. Most of the insurgents in Iraq were native Iraqis who had joined because they'd either been part of the Iraqi military, which was disbanded by Paul Bremer, the Coalition Provisional Authority, or they had been members in some fashion of Saddam's Ba'ath Party, the top three tiers of which were completely liquidated. So it precluded you, if you had been in any of those tiers, of participating in a new Iraqi government. So a lot of people were rendered unemployed, and they were rendered sort of abased by the U.S. policy, and they ended up joining some violent organization committed to extirpating the U.S. occupation. But AQI stood out because of the methods by which, well, they became famous, but also, you know, the sort of ultra-violence and the barbarity that they brought to bear. So, you know, AQI was the group that patented the on-air beheading of American hostages. Not just that, but the optics they used, dressing the hostages up in the Guantanamo Bay-style orange jumpsuits, all of these things. This was Zarqawi's brainchild.
Right, over al-Qaeda time, in Iraq.
Yeah, over time, you know, this was a foreign-led terrorist organization. It was mostly Jordanians and Tunisians and, you know, people from outside the country. But over time, there was an attempt to Iraqize it, because what they found was they were so gruesome and so brutal, and they had declared war against the majority sect of Muslims in Iraq, namely the Shia, that Iraqis began to see these guys, their former liberators or partners in defeating the Americans, as a separate form of foreign occupation. You know, don't be telling us, if you're from Tunisia or Saudi Arabia or Jordan, how to run our country and how to live our lives. So Zarqawi decided he's going to bundle al-Qaeda in Iraq into this consortium known as the Mujahideen Shura Council. In effect, it was a publicity stunt. I mean, it was still AQI was running the show, but all these Iraqis had now joined it, at least in name. The irony of this is that over time, all the foreigners became marginalized and sort of subordinate to the Iraqis. And it wasn't just Iraqis. It was Iraqis that had indeed been former agents of Saddam's regime. And this was something that was sort of in a Machiavellian way, kind of brilliantly conceived originally by Osama bin Laden. He knew the U.S. was going into Iraq in 2002. He issued a fatwa or a communique saying that it was incumbent upon all the mujahideen to form an alliance of convenience with what he called the socialist infidels. socialist infidels being members of Saddam's government. Today, if you look at who populates the ranks of ISIS and sort of ISIS central command, a lot of the people, certainly in the Shura Council, which is responsible for naming the caliph, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and making all the major decisions, they all had roles in Saddam's military or in his Mukhabarat intelligence service. So in a way, this is the return of Saddam Hussein. This is the return of his Ba'ath Party. So when you say, how did they manage to achieve all this? Well, these are state actors or former state actors who have proper military and intelligence training. You know, they were trained up by the East German Stasi or by the KGB. The guy who essentially founded the ISIS syndicate in Syria, Haji Bakr, he had been a colonel, I believe, in Saddam's air defense intelligence service. And a report by Der Spiegel obtained these documents that he cooked up. And they said this was like something out of the GDR in the 70s, the way he was running intelligence operations, counterintelligence operations, extorting people, finding out who the major players are in villages and towns in Aleppo, finding out everything you need to know about the families that run those towns, their sources of income, any kind of compromise or material that they could be blackmailed with. ISIS is not really a hugely formidable military power. We tend to sensationalize this. But what they're really good at is exploiting local populations, infiltrating communities, turning people, bribing their way. I was in Istanbul doing a big story for the Daily Beast on this, interviewing a former member of ISIS's Amniyat, which is their intelligence service, who he'd defected. And he told me before he defected, he sat down with the emir in Aleppo, who told him that we are basically going to send a lot of guys into the Free Syrian Army equipped with $200,000 or $300,000 in cash. Because with that amount of money, you can basically bribe your way through. You can control a non-ISIS militia and slowly convert all of its members into ISIS. This is how these guys are effective.
Indeed. And I'd like to just quote briefly from your book, from the introduction. You said ISIS is a terrorist organization, but it isn't only a terrorist organization. It's also a mafia adept at exploiting decades-old transnational gray markets for oil and arms trafficking. You said it's a conventional military that mobilizes and deploys foot soldiers. It's a sophisticated intelligence-gathering apparatus that infiltrates rival organizations. It's a slick propaganda machine effective at disseminating its message. And most of its top decision-makers, as you alluded to, either served in Saddam Hussein's military or security services. And
right.
You go on to say that ISIS presents itself to an embattled Sunni minority in Iraq and an even more persecuted and victimized Sunni majority in Syria as the sect's last line of defense against a host of enemies, such as the so-called infidel United States, apostate Gulf Arab states, and, of course, the Alawite dictatorship in Syria and the one in Iran. And that leads me to ask you then, is the stated U.S. policy of degrading and destroying ISIS feasible given current U.S. policies in Syria and Iraq?
No. I mean, I think it depreciates the political underpinnings of ISIS's salesmanship. First and foremost, you have to address the grievances that you just alluded to in the book. But our strategy, really, up until now, has been to partner exactly with the kind of enemies that ISIS has claimed the Sunnis are ranged against. We are backing Shia militia groups in Iraq, many of them very brutal and guilty of war crimes that compete with what ISIS has done, including, you know, burning people alive, all these beheadings and atrocities. Just don't take my word for it. Read Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International. In Syria, our primary ally is the Kurds. Now, the Kurds are Sunni, it's true, but they're not Arabs. And they have their own political project, which is to create Rojava, or, you know, the state of Syrian Kurdistan. The one force, the one sort of group of actors that we have not really been able to work with, or we have chosen not to in any kind of significant or meaningful fashion, are Sunni Arabs. You know, I mean, the reason that al-Qaeda in Iraq was strategically defeated in the 2007 to 2009 period, and I say strategically defeated, they weren't completely wiped out, but they had been reduced to such a point where they didn't pose such a dire and direct threat to the Iraqi state, is that the so-called al-Anbar or tribal awakening. Now, what this was, these centuries-old tribal confederations in western central Iraq, which had welcomed al-Qaeda in because, they saw them as liberators against the American hegemonic occupation, they turned against them because al-Qaeda in Iraq are brutal. And, you know, they were raping women, they were beheading sheikhs, and perhaps most importantly, that gray market economy that you mentioned, or the black market economy by which the tribes had enriched themselves for centuries, they had monopolized it. So all the smuggling of contraband material, oil, cars, weapons, you name it, AQI had sort of superimposed itself on that societal socioeconomic system. The tribes rose up against AQI and said, you know what, we don't like the Americans, we'd rather work with them, though. Because when they come in and they clear a town, they don't do pogroms. They don't do ethnic cleansing, unlike agents of the Iraqi government, which, you know, even if they're technically part of the Iraqi security forces in, you know, U.S. minted uniforms, by night, I mean, they moonlight as Shia death squads backed by Muqtada al-Sadr or by some other potentate in Iraq who more often than not is on the payroll of the Iranian government. So, you know, it's plus le change. I mean, everything, all the lessons we learned in the mid to late 2000 period, we have forgotten, and we are now making the same mistakes. You cannot work with IRGC proxies in Iraq and hope to turn Sunni Arabs against ISIS. It's just not going to work. In Syria, where demography favors a more robust, not really counterterrorism, but counterinsurgency policy, up until now, as I said, I mean, this Pentagon program, Train and Equip, where we said we're going to take a bunch of mostly actually Sunni Turkmen at the beginning, but Sunnis, Sunni Arabs eventually, and turn them into counterterrorism proxy forces of the United States. Well, you're injecting essentially, you know, human cannon fodder into not even a war zone, but a conglomeration of sideshow conflicts. These people had targets painted on their back because they were seen as hirelings of the West instead of nationalist or patriotic Syrians looking to eliminate two main enemies to Syria, namely Bashar al-Assad's regime and also ISIS. So right now, you know, you're seeing at the moment this kind of dual offensive, one from eastern Syria and one from western Iraq, led primarily by the Kurds, but not just one force of Kurds, the Peshmerga, but also the PKK affiliate. In Syria, it's known as the YPG, or the self-defense units, which are headed by the Syrian affiliate of the PKK. So Sunni Arabs see this as the U.S. is working with everybody but them. And that is the main capital, if you like, or the main leverage that ISIS wields, because they say, we are the only custodian and safeguard of the Sunni Ummah. Everybody is against us. There is a global conspiracy. It's led by the United States and Russia, backed by the Jews, but also United States and Russia now working with Iran. And in the case of Russia, it's really difficult to see where ISIS conspiracy theory ends and policy begins, because, you know, they've got joint operation rooms in both Baghdad and Latakia. Russia is working cheek by jowl with Hezbollah and the IRGC. The United States has said, we have no quarrel with you. You've imposed your own no-fly zone, so we can't do ours. And we just want to fight ISIS. We don't care about Bashar al-Assad. This is self-defeating as policy.
Right. And you say that, quote, whatever Washington's intentions, its perceived alliance of convenience with the murderous regimes of Syria and Iran is keeping Sunnis who loathe or fear ISIS from actually participating in another grassroots effort like the Awakening Sahwa to expel the terrorists from their midst. And that is very unfortunate.
Yeah. The other thing is the money. We don't have actual figures, and I'm very wary of anyone telling me how much money they're making per day from oil sales and all that. But I can tell you, they are flush with cash. And they have now turned this coalition war, which hasn't just bombed ISIS military targets or ISIS installations, but also bombed Syrian infrastructure by which many Sunni Arabs have made a living. And they say, look, you know, the United States is now depriving you of a livelihood. So come join ISIS. You'll have a welfare state. You'll have a patronage economy. I mean, again, this is from my interview with a former ISIS spy. He said, when you're in ISIS, you get free health care. If you have cancer, you need chemotherapy, and you can only obtain it in Turkey, ISIS will pay to send you to Turkey, to go to the best hospital, to stay in the nicest hotel, and it's all free. The salaries, you get about $100 a month, which is a king's ransom in contemporary Syria. If you have a wife, you get another $50. If you take care of your parents, you get $35 for each parent. So there's a state-subsidized program for anybody and everybody willing to work with ISIS, or willing, better yet, to join up. I mean, I hate the cliche, hearts and minds. I try never, ever to use it in writing or in speech, but there really is no other term for it. I mean, they're very clever at winning over local populations.
Yes, and actually, just as I was going to say, it looks like the United States' words don't necessarily match the deeds. The stated objective of destroying ISIS, the very strategy that we're pursuing, seems to be actually fueling it or bolstering it. But we have to take a break. First, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Michael Weiss. He's senior editor at The Daily Beast and co-author, along with Hassan Hassan, of the critically acclaimed book, ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA reporter Yaakovos Balassi. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Felix Momo from Edo, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. And now I'm going to turn to my colleague, Yaakovos Balassi, for a quick question.
Thank you. Going off of this group's success in exploiting the local populations and their ability to radicalize people, referencing your whack-a-mole reference in the book where we can get rid of one of these groups, but another is just going to pop up somewhere else. Clearly, a reactive, hard power-focused approach is not a solution and can actually add to the problem. So what are the measures that need to be taken in the long term to combat this process?
It's about providing a credible alternative to ISIS, right? So I mentioned Syria because, as I say, the sort of demography favors another awakening, another Sunni sort of revolution against the Takfiris. The problem is there is no alternative. The Free Syrian Army doesn't exist in Raqqa or in the ISIS heartland of the Jazeera. And even if it did, I mean, these guys were seen as corrupt brigands, unreliable, many of them infiltrated by ISIS sleepers. You need to essentially create and empower local actors. And, you know, I slightly disagree. It is a hard power situation. You need to give them weapons. You need to give them money. And you need to say to them, look, this stuff will keep on coming so long as you're fighting ISIS. And also, we will protect you not just from ISIS, but from the regime. You know, you rose up in the streets in 2011, not to overthrow, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, but to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. That is your raison d'etre. So we understand that, and we're going to offer you this umbrella. And, you know, look, one of the problems that the U.S. is having in foreign policy writ large is that our friends look at us as duplicitous and untrustworthy, and our enemies look at us as suckers. And Russia is quite good at backing up its friends, right? I mean, they backed Assad from the beginning diplomatically, economically, and now they're in there militarily. And they're not fighting ISIS. They're fighting everybody else. They're fighting the Free Syrian Army. They're fighting those Sunni militia groups the U.S. has backed and have been successful at holding the line against the regime. But again, this is the thing. We don't even tout our successes in doing the right thing. So you have these two programs in Syria. One was a Pentagon busted flush to create an anti-ISIS, as I say, Arab counterterrorism task force. That we heard about. That was on A1 of the New York Times. But the CIA program, which has done well to help pre-Syrian army actors basically go after Hezbollah and Assad, nobody wants to talk about that. And the reason we don't want to talk about it is we don't want to jeopardize this burgeoning detente or rapprochement that we're seeking with the Islamic Republic, which is a nuclear arms control deal, but we're also bringing Iran in many other ways, giving them a seat at the table to discuss the future of Assad.
But I have a question for you with regard to that, Michael. We're supposed to be compartmentalizing the nuclear deal and these other activities. The United States said that we would slam them hard.
A senior State Department official told me that the administration's only foreign policy objective for term two was, his words, rapprochement with Iran. The nuclear deal, I think, was a vehicle by which we were hoping to bring Tehran in from the cold. And you already see that backfiring in spectacular fashion. I mean, anybody with an Iranian-American or dual nationality is being hoovered up by the IRGC, which is now clamping down. You know, the IRGC has deployed ground forces into Aleppo. They're waging the fight even more than the regime at this point. And their National Defense Force, which is a wholly constructed IRGC subsidiary of, you know, essentially sectarian militiamen, without them, there is no Assad regime anymore. So, I'm sorry, I just don't buy this compartmentalization claim. I think this is holistic. And, you know, again, we fashioned a rod for our own back because, by all means, compartmentalize it. Do an arms control agreement, but don't lose sight of the fact that Iran is strategically our enemy in the region. They're backing a mass murdering dictator who is radicalizing Sunnis at an industrial scale. By letting him alone or by climbing down from these claims, he must step aside, he can't use chemical weapons, all these things, objectively aligning with him, that's a disaster.
Indeed. Let me ask you a historical if question. Back in 2011, to what extent then do you think that the inaction by the United States and the West, the so-called Friends of Syria, the inaction after the peaceful uprising in 2011, could we have forestalled the growth of ISIS had we acted to protect the protesters? Or was the moderate opposition, as they are called, really sort of corrupt, disorganized? There was just no hope. This is what a lot of people are saying. Well, that's easy for you to say, wishful thinking, sort of trying to justify the fact that we didn't act. That wouldn't have helped anyway. Would you disagree with that?
Yes, I would, because, look, I mean, there's so many different shibboleths that have been thrown out by Washington about why we didn't get involved in Syria from the beginning. Let's start with the whole, the FSA is farmers and pharmacists and dentists kind of claim that the president has put forward. I don't know if, how many journalists have gone to Syria. I went to Syria and Aleppo in 2012. I saw the rebels. I met them. Many of them had defected from the Assad regime. But even more than being inside the country, there's a whole camp in Turkey, a refugee camp, devoted to defectors from the Syrian military. And they all just sat around in tents all day, playing cards, smoking shisha, and talking on Skype as though they were actually running the Free Syrian Army when they weren't. Why didn't we go in and turn these guys into the Free Syrian Army? I joke only slightly glibly, I think it's actually the case, that Churchill had less to work with de Gaulle and the Free French during World War II than we did here. So you had this actual fighting force. I mean, these were professional soldiers. They were in active duty until they flipped. We did nothing with them. In terms of the corruption and all that, yeah, I mean, look, I've reported on it. Most of the Western hostages that ISIS has, not because they've been taken by ISIS, they've been taken by dirty rebels, non-ISIS rebels who have then sold them to ISIS or given them to ISIS in exchange for something. But when you have a civil war and you sort of leave it, you don't just have two sides. As I say, it proliferates into a series of internecine sideshows. ISIS really is a sideshow. They are not the main event. They became the main event because, as I said, I mean, it wasn't just Western inaction. This was a premeditated plan from the beginning by the regime to force the United States into the position it's now in. It's either me or the terrorists. Remember, Assad was saying 13-year-old boys giving water to protesters in the streets of Deraa. He's an al-Qaeda agent. In some cases, Syrian propaganda saying, you know, infants sleeping in their cribs who had to be beheaded by Shia militiamen. They're al-Qaeda, too. I'm not making this up. I mean, you can look it up. So why, for instance, was Hezbollah going around or the Shabiha going around, rounding up Sunnis and telling them to say there is no God but Bashar, kicking them, abasing them, pulling their beards? They were doing this to force them into a position of religious self-abasement, commit sacrilege on camera. So
and of course,
you will then turn to the jihadis who are going to come and offer you liberation. And I mean, again, forget everything
self-fulfilling
you think you know
prophecy.
About the Arab world or Islam. This came to me from the ISIS defector I just interviewed. He said, you know, if people are killing me, raping my family, spiriting my son away into some dungeon where he's going to have his genitals electrocuted, taking my daughter, putting her into a dungeon where she's going to have rats shoved into her vagina, and then somebody comes along and says, you know, the guys who did that, I know where they hang out. I know the checkpoint. I'm going to go up to the checkpoint. I'm going to drive a truck filled with explosives and blow them all to hell. Are you going to ask this person, I'm sorry, what faction do you belong to? Are you Jabhat al-Nusra? Are you ISIS? Can you give me your ideological agenda before I license you to get revenge for me and my family? No, it's human nature. It really boggles the mind that we didn't foresee this coming calamity. In fact, we did, because all of the excuse-making, well, we don't want to get involved in this morass because it's, we don't know who they are on the ground, and, you know, civil wars are messy. Indeed. And now it's become almost irretrievably messy. But at the very least, look, I never said, and I think even proponents of intervention, including John McCain, never said, what we need to do is just bomb the hell out of Damascus, blow open the doors of the presidential palace, pull Assad out and hang him upside down Mussolini style. Do another kind of shock and awe. That was a myth. Nobody after Iraq was suggesting that. The things that were being suggested at the time were at least give a no-fly zone to the people of northern Syria so that civilians can catch their breath. The U.S. government is pouring all this money in aid and development and, you know, helping with humanitarian relief, but all the money is being pissed into the wind because it's being stolen, or ISIS is coming and taking all the U.N. aid and the MRAP, the meals ready to eat kind of thing. So yeah, at the very least, even if you're a realist, it doesn't make sense to do this kind of half-cocked policy. The other suggestion, which around 2012 made a lot of sense, is, look, a lot of the death and destruction is being perpetrated from the Air Force. You don't even have to do a no-fly zone. Just take out the runways. Take out the helipads. We could do that from the sea. Why couldn't we do that? So it wasn't even regime change that was being suggested. It was regime isolation. Keep the butcher of Damascus away from his quarry. And at the very least, that would provide some real tangible evidence that the U.S. cared about the Sunnis. I say to people who ask me, well, what should be done? Wrong question. The question is, what is your objective? What would you like to do? Is it defeat ISIS? Guess what? You can't do that without engaging Assad. And I don't mean engaging him diplomatically. Is your objective to staunch the flow of blood and this wave of human refugees, which is now coming into Europe and going to change the politics of Europe in a very dire, reactionary fashion? Guess what? You can't do that without engaging Assad. It always comes back to the same thing.
Well, exactly.
So it doesn't matter what your ultimate goal is. You know, getting rid of this regime, or at least stopping it from perpetrating such violence and carnage upon its own people, that is the first line of business, and the U.S. has forsaken it. And look, what's so depressing to me is going into Iraq was probably the greatest strategic mistake in post-war America. I don't think there's really much of a controversy about that. But the one thing you can say that was at least gained in terms of American understanding and knowledge was how to turn Sunnis against Sunni terrorists. There is so much talent. There are so many members of military intelligence, colonels, and brigade commanders, people who really know. They can tell you village by village, town by town, who's in charge, and how the trains run. All these people are just being sort of shunted aside in favor of, I'm sorry to say, and I know I come across as a bit brash when I do it, but people who you wouldn't trust to mow your lawn, who've never been to the region before until they joined the administration because they worked on the campaign. Guys who have masters of fine arts and creative writing are essentially running national security, and it shows. This is what depresses me the most. Writing this book for me, with Hassan, it was more personal because he's from Syria. With me, it was a process of educating myself. Like, what did we learn from 2003 until now? And the answer is quite a lot. And it's like it's all been forgotten.
Quick question. How has Russia's intervention changed the situation?
What's surprising, to be honest, at least from where I'm sitting, is it hasn't actually helped the regime as much as I'm sure the Russians, the Iranians, and Assad would have liked. Again, you can take any number of sources here. The U.S. State Department calculates 90% of Russia's air war is devoted to non-ISIS targets, including, as I mentioned before, the CIA-backed Free Syrian Army units. RUSI, a British think tank, says it's more like 80%. So really, Putin is going after the credible alternative that I mentioned, or the people that would stand to inherit Syria if Assad were to fall, who aren't irredeemable, head-lopping terrorists. That's his primary objective. That said, the regime has really stalled in Hama area. Where they're having success now is Aleppo. That's mostly because of Iran's ground forces. The one place where they've been fighting ISIS is Queris Airport in southern Aleppo province. But really, I think Putin thought this would be a lot easier than it has been. The U.S., I have to say, in some fashion, is in a proxy war with Russia. We're allowing Saudi Arabia to provide these Tau anti-tank missiles to blow up Syrian army tanks and hold the line as Russia is dropping bombs from the sky and the regime and Hezbollah and the National Defense Forces and the IRGC are trying to push the rebels out by ground. Russia will only further radicalize the Sunni Arab population. I was in Istanbul. I mentioned what I'm hearing is actually Putin has done the Syrians a favor because where morale had been sagging, where people were feeling demoralized and like they were fighting everybody, they still feel like they're fighting everybody. But now people are actually returning to Syria from Turkey, vowing essentially that, you know, Russia says that this is an Orthodox Christian holy war against radical Islam. Well, the Muslims want to give them a holy war. And they think that they're going to basically turn this into another Afghanistan. But, you know, look, what we're now seeing is a return to the last 4 years of diplomatic theater. Another convention in Vienna, at which no Syrians are invited, of course, to discuss or negotiate the fate of their own country. But now Kerry is coming out and saying, well, you know, we're going to have to do a deal, and it doesn't necessarily mean that Assad has to leave power. You're seeing a lot of stuff in the media about this supposed tension between Russia and Iran. They actually don't see eye to eye. I don't believe that's the case. I mean, Russia from the very beginning has said, we don't care about Assad personally, we just care about our interests. Well, they always say that, and then you say, well, what's your solution? Well, we can do constitutional reforms, we can change up the pecking order inside the regime, but Assad can stand for president again for these early elections we're going to hold. Well, I mean, you have your answer right there. They're not getting rid of their client.
Exactly.
And they understand better than we do that there is no regime without the Assad family. Again, you know, I said ISIS is like a mafia. The Russian regime is a mafia state, according to our own State Department, or actually a Spanish counterterrorism magistrate quoted by the State Department. Assad is a mafia state. I mean, this is a kleptocratic dynasty. You know, you remove the family, everything collapses. Putin understands this.
The book is ISIS Inside the Army of Terror. The co-author is Michael Weiss. He's also a senior editor at the Daily Beast. Well, Michael, I can't thank you enough for your time and terrific insights. And once again, congratulations on your book.
Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Joe Gill. And joining me on the program was VOA reporter Iakovos Balassi. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.